Welcome back to the Hacking Neurodivergence Podcast, the podcast all about telling stories of atypical individuals like yourself and myself. I'm your host, Kelsey Terry, and in today's episode, we connect with yet another favorite person of mine. You're just going to meet all of them in a row. Her name's Becky, and Becky has ADHD. She's not officially diagnosed, but she identifies with a lot of the symptoms and, you know, benchmarks that align with having an ADHD brain. So we're going to hear about her life, her story, and I can't wait for you to hear it. Without further ado, here's my conversation with Becky.
Welcome to the show, Becky.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
In today's conversation, we'll hear about how you leaned into your ADHD while constructing sets and props in the theater scene in New York, your work as a CrossFit coach, prioritizing play in your long-term relationship with Danny, and the value of doing whimsical things. We'll then wrap up our time with some lightning round questions. How does that sound?
It sounds awesome.
Perfect. So tell me a little bit about your childhood. What stands out to you as you look back on your elementary and middle school years?
Oh my gosh, so much. In terms of this podcast, anyway, what I would say is that I was what one might generously deem a spacey child.
Okay.
There were times we were in the car and I was staring out the window and my mom was like, Becky, and she was like, I have called you four times. You are next to me. She'd been talking to me for like 20 minutes. You know, it was like one of those. And in my head, I had like characters in a book running around, you know, whatever, just off in La La Land constantly. There are some good things that I'm glad there was no videos when I was a kid on cell phones because, I mean, solid, like my brief interlude into attempting to play sports where, like, you know, I'm just like floor hockey, the goalie, just like staring off space, boom, goal right behind me. And I'm like, where'd all these people come from? My mom's just in the stands, like face palming. So definitely very spacey, very inquisitive. For all the spaciness, I actually did extremely well in school.
Great.
I was a pretty smart child, generally in honors classes, you know, figured out how to sort of do well in school pretty quickly, I think would be a reasonable way of saying that.
What was your favorite subject in school?
Ooh, I was English. I was big into English history. I liked history a lot. Yeah, I would say, especially in elementary and middle school, like when you got to specialize a little more in high school, I was really into, I had a mythology class that was super cool, which is kind of like the combo of English and history. So I really liked that. Yeah. Math was the only class that I was like deemed average in, but,
okay,
which is totally cool. Later in life, when I got to college, I was exceptionally good in like geometry and that kind of stuff, those visual things. But like physics doesn't, I don't, despite the fact I deal with it on a daily basis, like I'm just like, don't care.
Yes, I guess that's a little bit of a foreshadowing to your career.
Yeah, I suppose today. So. Dun, 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 dun.
Dun, dun, dun. So tell me about your household. Was it quiet? Was it loud? Small household? Did you have siblings growing up?
Yeah, good question. So I have one older brother. It was just the two of us. My house was very quiet for sort of interesting reasons. My mother was a pediatric emergency nurse, and my father was a general laborer. He worked in a lumber yard. He worked sort of all over the place. He was an ex-Marine from Vietnam and just came back and like dove into the just blue collar work in a variety of fields. And we were not wealthy in a very, very extreme way, especially when we were very little. It was interesting. Later on, when I was a babysitter, I encountered other families had the same problem that like to pay a babysitter, there was no point in the second parent working, yet they like needed to work kind of thing, right? And my mom was the main money earner. Plus, she swapped to night shifts because it was like a whatever percent increase in pay. And then what actually ended up is my dad would be home in the evenings and at night, and my mom would be home during the day. So, which means my mom slept a lot during the day. So we learned very early, do not wake mom up, except under these very specific circumstances. And so it was a fairly quiet household. We didn't get a lot of toys, like Christmas and birthdays, we get like just a few toys. But what I think is one thing that was very interesting and has definitely made a huge impact on my life is we were always allowed to have any book we wanted.
Oh.
Like, now granted, my mom was very careful when we went to the bookstore.
Sure.
You know, mm-hmm. but we could always have any book we wanted. And so not only did I read, and we weren't allowed to watch a lot of television, but I would read and reread and reread and reread. And so just like constantly in a book.
What kind of books were you picking out as a kid?
Oh man, lots of stuff. When I was a kid, I had a pretty epic horse phase. So like Black Stallion books. I have a copy of Black Beauty from 1903 that belonged to my grandmother
wow.
that I had fairly young as a kid. Read it, took good care of it. So I had a big horse phase. I had like the Babysitter's Club. Remember those?
Mm-hmm.
I was big into like the Three Investigators and the Hardy Boys.
Okay,
with a lot of those, the Boxcar Children.
Yes.
A lot of those. My brother, being 2 years older than me, got into fantasy, and then like those kind of passed down. So mm-hmm. a lot of those sort of classic Mists of Avalon, Dragonlance books, like a lot of like sort of high fantasy, that kind of thing. So
then on the fantasy side of things, were you involved in theater in your high school years?
Yes, I was.
Tell me more about that.
Yeah. So again, this is my big brother. My big brother, 2 years older, ran like sort of the sound and lights for the high school mm-hmm. theater. And then early on, he needed me to come in to help with something. And then I kind of like came in and ended up like sort of taking over mm-hmm. that sort of voluntary tech side of the program as I went through high school. And ended up sort of running stage crew and running the shows, stage managing and that kind of thing. And interestingly, though, there was some correlations before. I remember my mom took us to see like Disney on Ice. Remember
okay.
like the ice mm-hmm. capades kind of thing when I was younger, so pre-high school. And we had seats reasonably high up, which was perfect because I actually spent most of the time, my mom was so mad, watching the spotlight operator. Because
really?
The spotlight operator on those shows at that time, like, you know, granted, like 90s, mm-hmm. early 90s, late 80s, were like would sit in a chair and would rotate with it. And it just looked so cool. I was so into it. And so throughout high school, I volunteered. I ran the spotlight at our community theater, like did a lot of volunteer stuff around different jobs in the tech side of things.
With regards to your dad being in the trades, did he help you like build your skills in terms of like cutting and setting up sets?
No.
Or there was no overlap there?
Zero overlap. My father, God love him, great guy. His parents, so my grandparents were born in 1908 and 1912. So they had him in their 40s.
Okay.
So they're almost like my great grandparents if you look at generations.
Mm-hmm.
And they were very traditional in the fact that like there were boys things and girls things and never shall the two twine. And
oh.
So my father was not only raised that way, he even to this day like struggles a little bit with the fact that his son is a baker and his daughter's a carpenter. Like he has like a little bit of problems there, but you know, it's fine. It's a him problem, not a me problem.
Well, also that's a little bit of a foreshadowing to like what you're doing and helping people learn
yes,
how to
yes.
be more handy themselves.
Very much so, especially women. And it's, you know, it's a different world now than it was when
mm-hmm.
I was a kid. It's a different world when I was a kid than when my mom was a kid. You know,
mm-hmm.
my mom, I asked her one time, like, did you want to be a nurse? And she's like, listen, the options were nurse, teacher, secretary.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, but I like being a nurse. But you know, it was really, that was it. Those were sort of her main options.
Wow.
At least we're not there.
Yeah. I mean, I remember being a little kid and watching my dad as an entrepreneur. And the only women in his business were like the secretaries. And so
yeah.
my highest goal was to be a secretary for a very powerful man.
Isn't that crazy?
Like that's in my lifetime.
Representation matters.
Right? It
yeah.
definitely does. Especially, you know, you never know who you're a role model to.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. In high school, I took a digital electronics and an audio electronics class, and I was the only woman in both of those classes, the only female.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you dabble in tech, and you do a fair amount of it as a high schooler. Fast forward
yes.
to your 20s.
Mm-hmm.
What are you doing in your 20s?
Rocking it. What was I doing in my 20s? When I graduated college a semester early, so I got out at 21 and I got a job at a theater in Baltimore, Baltimore Center Stage, down in downtown Baltimore. And so I worked there for 2 or 3 years as the assistant technical director, assistant production manager. And when I got from there, I went actually to my first teaching gig. So then I moved over and I was technical director at Baltimore School for the Arts, which is a high school, mm-hmm. inner city Baltimore high school, for the arts. It's very interesting. If you've ever seen the, God, what are those dance movies with Channing Tatum in them?
Center Stage?
No, Magic Mike.
Center Stage?
Is it? Nope. Center Stage is a different one because this theater was called Center Stage. No, it's Step Up.
Yes.
The Step Up movies take place at MSA, Maryland School for the Arts, but it's actually BSA, Baltimore School for the Arts. Like they even shoot some of the scenes there. So.
Really?
Yep. That's where I used to work. So it's not exactly like in the movie, to be clear. but that was like my first sort of teaching gig, which started... It started like a lifelong, honestly, career of teaching in such a wide variety of ranges that it was like 10 years before I really realized that I was effectively a lifelong teacher of just many disciplines.
So. And so were you naturally drawn to teaching, or was it like, they just need someone to fill the spot and I guess I'll do it? Tell me about that like first time you started teaching.
The first time I started teaching formally, which would have been at Baltimore School for the Arts, it was to a degree a job that I wanted, I was interested in, I needed it. Mm-hmm. That was a very steep learning curve, I gotta say, because we were actually discussing this before we started, but I look young for my age now. So imagine me at 23.
I would look like a child.
I looked like a child to the point where as I was teaching there, I was at one point I was in the elevator and the another teacher was like, what are you doing in the teacher elevator? And I was like, going to the third floor, you know? And she was like, are you supposed to be here? And I was like, yes. And it didn't even occur to me like the problem. And then I think there was actually some sort of PSA that went about that they were like, there's a really young teacher in the theater department, because then someone came in and went to my sophomore Lucy and said, are you the young teacher? And she was like, I'm a sophomore. But like, granted, standing next to each other, we both looked about 17, so it's cool.
I'm curious, when you were teaching, how do you think maybe your neurodivergence showed up looking back at that time?
Looking back at that time, and to be clear, like, I didn't realize I was neurodivergent until I heard the term, which was seriously in the last like 5 years tops, like 3 to 5 years. So then it was like, aha, this all makes sense. I think that having this neurodivergence has actually made me a very effective teacher, because I've had to learn to communicate. Like, it was to learn to communicate effectively with a variety of people, and just constantly changing and being able to change my communication style until it works. And so I think that made me a very effective teacher. I don't know if it makes me empathetic or if I was sort of naturally empathetic, which either way, thank you, world. but it certainly helped me with that. The kids actually really related to me. I remember one of them one time, they were talking about another teacher and they're like, yeah, Miss So-and-so definitely stepped outside her teacher box on that one. And then they looked at me and they're like, you never had a teacher box. And I was like, cool. but it made me very approachable at the very least. Those kids would come to me for advice on tattoos, like on like all kinds of stuff, which my main advice for young kids is wait till you have money, so otherwise you're gonna end up with a cover-up or removing it at some point. Wait till you have enough money to get a good tattoo. And like random life advice, they emailed me for tons of time afterwards. I was a bridesmaid at one of their weddings. Like, it really like, like a sort of lack of awareness of certain things in my life. Mostly social sort of like parameters, not inappropriate, but like, you know, just sort of like this, you know, barrier. I don't know. Maybe we should just edit that out. That sounds. But I think that having sort of that just very open, like that kind of like attitude that I've always had, made me approachable, made the kids kind of relate to me a little bit more, at least some of them, if that helps.
Yeah, that makes sense. So how do you go from, or tell me about the transition from your time in Baltimore and then going up to New York City and your career there.
Yeah. So, well, I, it's funny, even though I've only come to, and as we discussed earlier, but for the sake of listeners, I have never been formally diagnosed with anything. Mm-hmm. But I don't personally feel the need to. And,
I would agree.
But it doesn't mean it's not there. So what I did notice early on, actually, as a high schooler working in the theater, I enjoyed it. I was good at it. I was hit perfectly where no one else wanted to take it on. So I got a lot of responsibility. I've always done well with a lot of responsibility. I can dig in. I can hyper-focus. I'm like, bam, got it. And that drove me into career theater. But one of the things that was most appealing about it mm-hmm. to me was the fact that it's constantly different. You're always doing a different show. And even if you do the same show, it's a different production of it. So one example that's easy to give is, like, I've done Macbeth many, many times, but it's never the same. I've done Macbeth set in the 1940s. Literally, the set was Stonehenge. I did that in college. I've done Macbeth set in an office building high rise. I've done Macbeth, you know, in the traditional sense, traditional sort of Shakespearean setting. So the fact that it's constantly different always appealed to me. And I did somewhere deep in my brain recognize early on that that was, like, going to be a good choice for Becky. that the same day in and day out was a bad choice for Becky. So now fast forwarding into mm-hmm. my 20s, look at me staying on track. Fast forwarding into my 20s, I definitely job hopped a lot. Like,
sure.
Mm-hmm. way before I heard the term neurodivergence, my mom used to joke that I had job ADD at the very least.
Okay.
So I went from teaching or working at Baltimore Center Stage to teaching at Baltimore School for the Arts. In the summer, I was a swimming instructor. I helped manage a swim and tennis club. At that point, I was like, I don't know what I want to do. I was mm-hmm. nannied a lot. I actually, at that point, and at this point, I was 24, maybe 25, started traveling. And that was a huge boon on my life, I have to say. Really helped me figure out a way to present myself in a lot of situations.
Tell me more about that.
Yeah. So I would say one hallmark looking back on my life of the neurodivergence is that it took me a while to put together that what's happening in my brain is not happening on the outside for a degree, and that what I think I'm communicating, I'm by no means communicating, which is why I think being a neurodivergent has made me an extremely good communicator in the end, for the most part. And this ranges from realizing in college that my face didn't match my thoughts and emotions.
Ooh. Yes. Do you have an example or a story of that?
Sure. Well, when I was a kid, like I said, and even now as an adult, when I'm unguarded, like I told you, my boyfriend comes in watching me having full-on, very animated conversations with myself, out loud, full hand gestures, you know, full range of emotions, like honestly happening as I'm having this conversation with myself. And he's often comes by and he's like, oh yeah, really? Or he's like, he'll just walk past me and go, who's winning? And so, but as a kid, that was all out there. And I had to learn to tap it down and to just like appear neutral. And so I somewhere along the lines learned how to appear extremely neutral. And then I had to learn how to layer in the appropriate motion back over that.
Wow.
So
okay.
Yeah. And I think one thing was in college, I was in the theater department for whatever. And I remember walking out on stage and I was, not feeling well. Like I was just, mm-hmm. I think my allergies or something, I just wasn't feeling well. And so I was like a little subdued, but like everyone was kind of like giving me looks. And I went over to a friend of mine and I was like, hey, what's going on? I went to give him a hug and he gave me a hug. He goes, oh, thank God. He's like, I thought you were mad at me. And then the entire group was like, oh, I thought you were mad at me. And I was like, I just have allergies. But I realized that like my range of emotions is like, can be a lot. Like I can be a lot. And learning to make sure, not even regulate my emotions, like you regulate them to a degree, right? Mm-hmm. But like I learned to regulate my emotions as a child, as most people do. But to make sure that it doesn't bleed onto other people at all, kind of thing.
Sure. And there sometimes can be like those unintended consequences where you didn't want to appear that way. And so 100%. You became more self-aware.
Much more self-aware going forward. Exactly. So that was a big one, learning of the like the face versus the inside and what's going on. And also Yeah, I mean, I think that's probably one of my more solid examples of that, to be honest.
Sure. So you spent how many years in New York City?
10.
And New York City, from what I gather, I've never been to the place, but it seems like that would just be beyond sensory overwhelm in terms of the sounds, the sights, the smells, the people that are just in every corner. Mm-hmm. So how the heck did you navigate such, you know, a massive city with all that possibly, you know, overwhelming your senses?
Yeah. Some days very poorly. Okay. I have to admit. Yeah, interesting. And you really hit the nail on the head right off the bat there. It is a sensory overload. And so in many ways, living in New York for 10 years made me significantly worse as a person.
As a jerk or like with ADHD?
With ADHD, my ability to concentrate, my cortisol levels being high, me being constantly stressed and overwhelmed. But on the other hand, it taught me a lot more coping mechanisms, drove me into finding management techniques.
Okay.
And really helped me sort of focus down on what I wanted out of life. I instinctually feel like I should say I had this bad habit, but I don't think it was a bad habit, honestly. I had a habit that yielded sometimes really wonderful things of ooh, a penny, or like, ooh, a puppy. Like, I would be going through life and it's like, job offer. Ooh, job offer. Okay, we'll go over there. I have nothing to do this month. What's not allowed? Oh, tickets to Ecuador are really cheap. Ooh, Ecuador, you know, just rent out my apartment in New York. I actually did that one time. I spent a month in South America, actually. This was in South America. And rented out my apartment in New York and saved money for the month, even though I wasn't working.
Sure, you're traveling.
With the expenses and everything. So just the ability, I truly, truly have leaned into a desire and ability to kind of like go follow opportunities they come / go where the wind blows you kind of thing. And being in New York really helped me narrow down the fact that I do need some parameters in my life. So to kind of get back to the core of that question, how did I navigate it? I started journaling when I was on the subway. As a use of my time there, as opposed to being on my phone or even reading a book, I started journaling. That was fascinating. What came out of this head on that one, in terms of just like, it helped me identify patterns in my life that I needed to work on, shall we say, both in relationships and, just what was constantly making me unhappy or constantly making me unsettled. Did you want to say something?
Yeah. What format, there's infinite ways one could journal.
Yeah.
So was there a structure to it, or was it just like, this is what's running through my mind right now?
Yeah.
And was it unstructured? Tell me about not the contents, but how did you approach journaling?
Yeah, I approached journaling in the way that I had to sit down and write something. And that was it. I don't do well with strong parameters. I know that about myself. I will rebel against myself. Even if I set them, I'll be like, oh yeah, you're not the boss of me. And then I'll not do it. So, so the thing about journaling is I just had to do it. So there were many days where my journal entry started with I have nothing to say today. I'm on the subway doing this. And then some days that was it. But most of the time something would pop up and I would just write it down. No matter what it was. And then but a lot of times that would spiral. And the thing was, it's like, if I let my brain go, it will keep shoving to the forefront, what it wants me to deal with.
Work through.
Yeah. New York is also where I learned about the power of meditation and what that does for me and myself. And also I'm a textbook extrovert. I recharge around people. However, too much interaction can be too much interaction. So I learned one of my favorite things is to go to a museum by myself. Love it. Love it. I'm such a nerd. I want to see the exhibits. I want to sit and look at them. I want to take time to soak into them. I don't want someone else that I have to interact with. I can be in that private bubble. But there's people around me. And so I still get that sort of energy recharge.
I love that. In your time in New York, you had a variety of jobs. Tell me about some of those other roles.
Very much so. Well, I actually, hilariously, I have a degree in technical theater, theater technology, a BA in theater, focus on tech, however you want to look at it. And I did not move to New York for theater. Oddly enough,
what?
At that point, I know, crazy, right? At that point in my life, I was already, and I was 28, a little disenchanted with the entertainment industry, which is a tough industry in many ways, in the fact that it is very much prone to producing martyrs, honestly, people that will work themselves to death for almost no money. And they thrive on that. It thrives on that. The industry couldn't survive without that. Which I have issues with, and I think one should have issues with. On the other hand, the cool things I learned to do cannot be understated. So when I was moving to New York, I was in Baltimore for about 8 years. And when I was leaving Baltimore, I was traveling a lot. There were several years there, like golden years, where I spent the winter backpacking, like around Europe, around Central America, South America. I went to India, Australia, New Zealand, all over. And then I would come back, and in the summer, I continued to manage swim and tennis club for a little bit. And then I found an artist who was a glass and metal artist. He did fabulous stuff. It was Holy Terra Studios in Baltimore. In a neighborhood called Hamden. And he was a decent welder, but it wasn't actually his forte. So I actually went in as his welder. And I used to go in and weld his art together. And then he taught me how to do stained glass work. And that's why I got a little more into more of a sculpture artistic exposure. Not to say that I learned to be an artist or a sculptor at all, but I got a lot of exposure to it, which is a huge part of learning anything. And so I did that, and I kind of like tooled around there. And then at one point, when I was at Baltimore School for the Arts, I took my students on an educational tour to Spain. And while I was over there, I was kind of watching everyone. And later on, a few years later, it reoccurred to me that like that could be a job for me. And so I actually went into educational tour guiding. And I did that for many years. And that's a spring job, essentially. And it was kind of perfect because I was like, finally, my love of useless, completely random facts is relevant to something that pays me money. It was great. And I loved it. It would take a lot of eighth grade trips. Like when you learn about American history in eighth grade, a lot of times you take a trip afterwards. So if you were extra lucky on your trip, you get picked up at the airport by me. And we would spend 3 to 5 or 7 days together. And I would take kids. I did tour directing in Boston, New York, D.C., Philly, Williamsburg, and the Civil War battlefields. And then I was a licensed tour guide in New York, and I tour guide in D.C. I never got my license, though. So I won't tell anyone. Great.
So to go back, you mentioned that the arts really thrives on martyrs. So did you see yourself as saying like that you didn't want to be a martyr? Or tell me like the connection there in terms of that realization you had and then shifting out of the arts.
Yeah, I mean, there's just a point where as much as you want to be like, I do art and it's great, there's a point you have to pay your bills.
Absolutely.
There is. And there's a point where I was tired of just struggling all the time. That's all there is to it. I worked in nonprofits, you know, even teaching. Like I taught it at NYU, and that is one of the top universities in the United States. Mm-hmm. It has the second largest undergrad theater program in the world. No, wow. It might actually be the largest in the world. And I made less than one student's tuition for the year.
Wow.
Yeah. And that's tough in New York.
Absolutely.
You know, like I worked at NYU and also worked as a bike messenger.
Sure.
Fun bucket list job. But like, you know what I mean? Like, should that be the case? Maybe not.
Maybe
you know?
Not.
But there was a point where now, granted, I will also point out I did have an opportunity to join the union and I didn't take it because when I first moved to New York, I never wanted to live in New York. When I first moved there, I thought I was moving there for about 6 months because I was dating someone who was going to go to the Culinary Institute there. That was a 6-month program. And I was like, cool. So I didn't even bother getting into theater when I got to New York. I actually was tour guiding at that time. I worked as a tour guide in New York. And then eventually I kind of just like, suddenly I was in New York for 10 years. It was like one of those, you know, I'm like, what is going on? I'm still here. And at that point I had been a tour guide. I had been a nanny. I had gotten back into theater. I had been teaching. I was at Columbia for about a semester. Then I went down to NYU for 3 years. And while I was at NYU, so when I was at NYU, I was in my early 30s at this point. And, fun transition time. I was starting to get back pain, and I was starting to get a lot of sort of repetitive motion injuries that happens a lot in the trades, even like technical theater's trade work. Mm-hmm. And so in that time period, I actually started weightlifting, and I was steered towards CrossFit in a way that I find the universe likes to do, this personal belief of mine, that if like three different people who were completely unrelated, didn't know each other in random different parts of my life within a course of 6 weeks told me to do CrossFit. And I was like, okay, world.
Sure, I guess I'll
try CrossFit. And I lucked into going into what was a very good gym at the time, and it changed my world. So talk about a different coping mechanism. Not only brain clarity from working out, better energy, better focus, less chronic pain for sure. And also helped me in my job big time, you know? And so that was very good. And so while I was working at NYU, after I was bike messengering, when I quit that job, I ended up started coaching part-time. And then I left that job at NYU and ended up coaching full-time for several years, until I was eventually offered a job at the University of Colorado. It was just an intern position for 1 year. And I left New York and went there. And that started us on a magical tour across the United States, where I went Colorado, Michigan, Texas.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you try CrossFit. It works out for you. You see the benefits.
Yes.
And so full disclosure, Becky also coaches Tyler and myself. And so that's how we know Becky. But you take this really unique approach to wellness. It's not just, you know, what is your grip strength?
No.
Or
which
you
is
know,
cool.
Breaking 90 degrees when you do that squat.
Yep.
but I'm curious, how else do you think about wellness beyond the traditional just building muscle?
Oh my gosh. It is an entire package. Mm-hmm. Like, I can back up to the point of the sort of like dumb jock stereotype is, you know, factually inaccurate when you look across the data on people, that as soon as you finish exercising, you're better able to learn and absorb information. You're very, very smart. You learn a lot. It increases your confidence. You learn the ability to do hard things, which just, you know, just you can just extrapolate that through your entire life. In addition to that, helps regulate hormones, particularly, you know, cortisol, your stress, and like as sort of like a toehold into a healthier lifestyle. Mm-hmm. It was after I was working at CrossFit, working as a coach, the first gym I was at, it was called CrossFit Long Island City. It no longer exists, sadly, but it was in New York, in Queens. And the owner of that gym made all of his coaches try different diets, shall we say.
Okay.
Different.
How'd that go?
Great. Oh my God. Great. Actually, I learned so much about myself.
Really?
Yes. Yes, I did. Because I had tried several different things. I grew up not really liking meat. So I was a vegetarian for quite some time. It turns out I just didn't like the meats my mom cooked.
Sure.
I still hate pork chops. Sorry. Still hate pork chops. I'm not a big fan of chicken and turkey. Now I've learned to eat chicken more, mm-hmm. but I was not a big fan at the time. My mom cooked a lot of pork chop and chicken breasts. And I was bleh. I prefer steak, bison. I like game meat. I'll do chicken thighs. I'll do chicken breasts at this point. But anyway, exposure to that was nice. But back to the CrossFit diet thing. I learned a lot about a cleaner diet.
Okay.
And that helped me in so many areas of my life. Not only in my ability to like focus and concentrate, I will also say that CrossFit is a community, which is nice. And so like it helped me with adult relationships and like more of that communication style. Mm-hmm. That was definitely helpful. But in those initial diets, some of the big kickers that I think everybody can benefit from was little to no sugar, added sugar, processed sugar, and watching little to no processed foods. Like you can start there. I, in addition, am gluten-free, which definitely helped, but did not completely, fully fix.
A magic bullet for
you. It wasn't a magic bullet. It was like, oh, crap, food does affect me, mm-hmm. kind of like eye-opening moment. Mm-hmm. But sugar is the biggest one for me. And I have to say something that I think is very misunderstood. Three things that are very misunderstood. Added sugar can have so many names. Like there's over 200 names or something like that for sugar. Definitely over 100 for factual accuracy. I believe 200, but definitely over 100. And so you have to look in the ingredients, because a very misunderstood thing is on the back in the chart of nutrition facts, there's something that says sugars, and it can say 0 grams. And then down in the ingredients, it can say Splenda or, any of the atolls that... Mm-hmm.
Sucrose.
And... Sucrose, yeah. The OSIS, dextrose, sucrose. Thank you. I needed mm-hmm. some help there. I appreciate you. So that can be listed in the ingredients, but it says no sugar. Mm-hmm. And then on the front, they can say no added sugar. Mm-hmm. And that is like companies getting around packaging. So you have to look at the ingredients. That is the only place to determine what you're eating. Okay. That is one thing that's very misunderstood. Secondly, fruit is not the devil, right? Fruit has sugar, yes, but it is natural sugar.
Okay.
And it is in a package you're supposed to be able to consume, right? Okay. It's like, I forget exactly what it is, but I think the amount of sugar in a Coke, and again, I think I didn't fact check this ahead of time, but I believe the amount of sugar in the Coke, in one can of Coke or one bottle of Coke, would be the equivalent of eating like 7 feet of sugar cane. Which is like physically impossible, mm-hmm. right? You see what I mean? And so it's packaged so tight. And that's why, yeah, and we can fact check that for later. But I believe that's the equivalent. So you're not worried about the apple, right? You're literally comparing apples and Cokes, right? It's not the same. So fruit is not the enemy. If you're trying to lose a lot of weight, just like maybe keep it to like one piece a day, instead of like four per meal, you don't want to do mm-hmm. that. But everything in moderation. And then the other major thing is like I go back and forth to this with my mother, who is an absolutely phenomenal human all the time, where she's like, I don't eat that much sugar. And she is correct. She does not eat that much sugar compared to your average American. However, too much sugar is more sugar than you can handle. And I can handle almost no sugar. Like I am a toddler with sugar. Like I get hyperactive. I get a little angry and then I fall asleep. Like it's embarrassing. Like I just eat like I'll get myself a little pint of ice cream. It'll last me roughly 6 to 8 weeks because I'll take like a little bite at a time. Danny gets a pint and crushes it in like 30 minutes. He's just like, yunk. Being genetically very similar to my mother, she has diabetes. She has a hard time regulating her blood sugar. She's like, I don't eat that much sugar. And I'm like, no, but you eat too much for you, as evidenced by these problems. And like, just genetically, we're not superior people, Mom. Like we just can't handle a lot of things and we need to accept that. So you got to figure out where your sugar tolerance is. And the only way to do that is to cut it out entirely for like minimum 2 weeks, preferably 4 to 6 weeks, and then just add in a tiny bit and just see how your body reacts. And you might find it very interesting. Like suddenly you're having crashes, suddenly you're having cravings, suddenly you have brain fog is back, you need a nap in the afternoon. Like a lot of things can happen with that. And it's just very little of the time. But you have to figure out where you are and not compare yourself to like sort of like the ideal that they're selling as a standard American diet.
Absolutely. Next, I want to talk to you and hear about your relationship with Danny. Two things that stand out about your relationship that I've been able to observe. Number one is that you're very, very self-aware. The two of you have a high degree of self-awareness as a couple, which is awesome.
That's nice to hear.
And then the second thing is this idea of play mm-hmm. in a relationship. And so Danny also attends the same gym that you coach at. And let me ask you, does he join your classes, or is it just better for your relationship that he be coached by someone else?
No, he joins my classes. Yeah. We had a brief period of time where when he first started working from home and I was only coaching. Mm-hmm. And so we were home all the time. And then I'd go to the gym and he'd come to my class. And then we'd come back and I'd be like, you need to go to someone else's class for a hot second. But that was like, I had no opportunity to just be alone in the house for an hour. Sure. You know, and sometimes mm-hmm. you just need that. Mm-hmm. But outside of that period, no, he's good. He's great. He's respectful. He's generally coachable. He frequently doesn't listen, but that's not a me thing. That's fine.
That's just him.
I'm like, hey, do 10 with the barbell. He does 5 and puts it away. I'm like, that was 10. He's like, oh, you said 10. And I'm like, that's cool. It's fine. It's not a big deal. You know.
Moving on. And so when it comes to this idea of play or being playful, I mean, I guess, well, let's back up for the audience. How many years have you been in relationship with Danny?
6.5.
Okay.
6.5. Yes.
Congrats.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. My longest relationship, his shortest.
And so like the world can just be, you know, just so difficult, right? Just as any, you know, circumstances that rise up, it's really easy to become almost hardened by the difficulties that life can present itself, whether you're remodeling a home, you're thinking mm-hmm. about a new career. How do you guys keep play or playfulness at the center of your relationship or like be cognizant of that?
Ooh, that's a great question. And I would be interested to hear Danny's answer on this separately. But I would say that, first of all, we're both absolutely ridiculous, silly people. And mm-hmm. that helps. You know, we are by nature very silly people. The other thing that I think is huge in our relationship that I can't tell you how incredibly lucky I feel on a regular basis for this. But we, at least I believe, we fully 100% trust each other. Like there's no real subjects that are off, you know, off limits for us. Mm-hmm. We can ask extremely difficult questions or extremely personal questions. And we just trust that the other person will never, ever, ever use that against us. And we never have. And as if I'll have it, we never will. You know, like even mm-hmm. if we lash out, it's never an attack. You know, we also don't really lash out. Like when we argue, it gets very specific. Danny's a machinist. He's kind of like an engineer brain. And he'll be like, but I said this exact word with this inflection. And I'm like, you're missing the point. You know? and so it gets like real specific on communication. So there's a deep level of trust there, a very deep level of trust that I've never had in another relationship and I recognize is special. And because of that, you can kind of just let yourself go and mm-hmm. be ridiculous all the time. And so we let our inner absurdities out. And like, even if it gets a little out of control, we don't ever like shut the other person down. You know, we're just like, I'm like, okay, like that went somewhere unexpected. And just like let it go, you know. And then in addition, I have always been a fairly like playful person. For instance, for my birthday every year, I try to learn something. I love activities. That's my favorite thing. It's like quality time is one of my main love languages. And so I'm always like, you know, we have to go do something, you know, like for my 40th birthday, we went and learned how to paraglide in Utah, you know.
Wow.
For my 30th birthday, I went to Australia to learn how to windsurf. Have I windsurfed since? Once. Once. you know, I've like everything from like I took a class in Japanese sumi-e, ink painting to I took a class on how to tailor jeans. That was very useful. Honestly, it was very, very useful. At the very least, they taught us how to cut the pocket and put in a bigger pocket.
So like, your female hands could fit?
Yes. Yes. My giant female hands. I mean, look at these mitts. But any female hand, like, you know, something above a 4-year-old can fit in the pockets now. And he's like, Danny's an extreme introvert and he can be hard to get out of the house, but he's also very open. And when I do drag him out afterwards, he will reflect and be like, thanks for getting me out of the house. That was fun, you know, kind of thing, which is nice. So it can be hard to get him going, but he's always like, he's good about like pondering and being like, actually, thank you for that. That was nice. So
you're currently doing a full scale renovation of your home, your new home.
Sure are.
How have you navigated that as a couple? How do you walk that walk?
Oh, yeah, that's been interesting. Again, there's a lot of, I think, especially on my part, I'm a little more prone to this, a lot of self-reflecting and moments of, you know, I'll come back and I'll be like all the time. Like we did this happened the other night where I was like, hey, you know how I just said that to this other person? I'm sorry, that had an air of condescendingness and I never want that in a relationship and I'm so sorry for that. I'll do better next time, like that kind of thing. And like just trying to nip it in the bud. Like I try to keep tabs on that. I come from a somewhat passive aggressive household. And so I'm very, very on top of like never allowing that to happen. And it's a lot of self-regulation and self-reflection. With the navigation, it has, we've had more struggles with than we've ever had in our relationship. I think we're doing just fine, but it has been hilarious because I've learned a lot more about the fact that Danny's brain works, unfortunately, much closer to the way my brain works than I ever realized before.
Really?
Yes. Like I always say that my brain, I feel like, is like a computer with like 16 open tabs mm-hmm. on it running all the time, which makes me very good at I'm very good at managing a project. Honestly, if it's one project, I'm not good at managing multiple projects. So now you're looking at multiple browsers with several tabs open at the same time. Mm-hmm. And that's where we have diminishing returns. but like on one project, all these things open and like, you know, I can like, I've got it. We think ahead. We do the whole thing. An example of this would be like, we were talking about something we were doing in the kitchen, like where we're putting this versus where the sink's going versus where the stove's going, that kind of thing. And like, we were in there, we talked about it. I drafted it for him to look at. We stood in the space. We did this. We, in my opinion, agreed on something. Like he was like, yeah, this, yeah, that sounds good. I think that's what he said. Yeah, that sounds good. And I was like, great. And then like a week and a half later, he's like, well, maybe we should consider this, and brought up something we had already discussed and removed. And I was like, well, we're not going to do that because I've already ordered everything for this, for it to get here in time for us to do the thing. Like that's all been managed and taken care of. But for him, I don't know if he either just didn't realize we had made a decision or his tabs were going. And so he was only kind of listening and kind of processing sure. at the same time. And then like when this closed down, he could fully, he was like, oh, la, la, la. And I'm like, no, no, my friend, that ship has sailed. Like we have already bought that and that is over, you know? And so that was very interesting. So I've actually learned to give him the courtesies that he's learned to give me that I just didn't realize he needed. And so, something that would be like when he's doing something, I'm like, hey, is now an okay time to ask you about a thing? Like, is this a good moment for you to focus on, you know, the paint color, the this, the that? Like, is it okay? And then he can like take himself out and shift and go. Or not. Or he can be like, actually, later would be better, you know? And that's like, that's been very helpful in our relationship. But it has been an interesting learning curve. Like, yeah.
Absolutely. And I mean, a whole home renovation is a pressure cooker for any couple.
Yeah, yeah. So in that case, I think we're crushing it.
Yeah, absolutely. So with regards to your love of whimsical things, how is that taking center stage in your life today?
Oh, very good question. So I will say there was a moment when I was a teenager where I look back on, and I've mentioned this several times, like I think one of the best moments in my life was when I was grew up enough to learn to play again, you know? And that was like getting over ye old sadly unavoidable pitfall of taking yourself way too seriously when you're like a teenager, you know? C'est la vie. There's photographic evidence that never needs to be shown on that. But like there was just a point, I think I was actually still a teenager, but later in my teenage years, where I think I was just like walking with a friend of mine and we just were walking past the school and we just went on the playground. And like it was like a great like evening, and like we just swung on the swings and like played on the monkey bars and it was just so much fun and it was so freeing and delightful. And I love that moment happened in a profound way, because I think I was able to carry that through life. So there's that sort of thing has like driven a lot of what I do in terms of those, like, what am I learning for my birthday this time, you know? I'm gonna go do this, gonna go do this, and like keeping that in life. And fortunately, that like brought me right into a career in theater. Like some of my favorite things I've ever built have been sets with like secret tunnels. There's this opera where I don't remember the opera. I'm sorry. I can tell you it took place at Opera Theater of St. Louis. And we had to build a giant nest with three eggs that were like yay big that we then had to cut because choral members had to like pop out of them as chicks. And like the props people like teching through that, there's the photos of us like in the prop shop, like in it, and then like popping out and being like, and there's like all these fun things you got to do. I had to build a giant table that I got to sit on. There's a photo of me doing that somewhere. I had to build a car that was really cool. It was actually a working electric car. That's like a crowning piece in my portfolio. It was a really cool build. But just like having to, you know, having to build crazy stuff. And in theater, it can get, or in the entertainment industry, I did theater. I did, you know, everything from Broadway down to community theater, touring shows, museum displays, the Macy's windows one year I worked on, the Christmas windows, conventions. Conventions are often in that theater world, that sort of fabrication scenic world. And like a lot of times it can be very frustrating. Like you have to build something that you might not be interested in. You have to build it to someone else's often possibly unreasonable expectation.
Never.
Never. You deal with a lot of very artistic personalities that can be very big and very strong. And, you know, keeping that sort of sense of wonder, I think, really helps you not become sort of jaded. You're dealing with very tight timelines. You never have the money you want to really finish anything to your full satisfaction, you know. And so you can either just fall back and just kind of clock in and clock out and like be like, oh, I'm building a 20-foot armoire, like, all right. Or you can be like, I'm building a 20-foot armoire that like a person rolls out of as if they're, you know, this big. And like, that's cool, you know, it's kind of fun. And so I think keeping that sense of wonder really helped. And when I eventually sort of like left the entertainment industry, which I fully did about 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. And then I still coach part time, but I started building a business. And this is like maybe the third or fourth time I've kind of like started this. But I was able to fully commit this time. Which is a lot of luck, honestly, like happenstance, like where I am, the fact that Danny can support us while I do this, you know, a lot of that, mm-hmm. the support network I have, the people I know, there was a lot that just came together perfectly. But when I started building stuff, sort of a custom fabrication business, I was doing a lot of very, very what I would deem boring things, you know, built-ins and shelves and tables and fine. But like, I was just like, I wasn't happy. And I was having a struggle with that. I was struggling with that because I was like, you're finally kind of doing what you want. Mm-hmm. You're not beholden to anyone. You can build this any way you want. Why are you so dissatisfied? And it was that missing layer of whimsy, of fun, of art, of creativity, of play. And so I was very lucky to meet a client that I'm working with right now who really helped me. She also like functions as my business coach. It really helped me kind of like focus down what I want to do. And we're doing like a giant built-in in her playroom. And the center one rotates as a secret door into an office, you know, kind of thing. And then I realized that like, really, I just want to build scenery like in your house. That's what I want to do. So we just need some like theater magic, you know, like hidden door, like magic staircase, you know, the island opens up and it's actually a wine cellar. You know, your kids need a climbing wall, like it's a tree, but you can climb it, you know, cargo net floors. You need a tree house, like. Need a slide next to the staircase, stuff like that. And like adding that back in has been the missing ingredient. So
you're doing more whimsical designs and carpentry. Tell me a little bit more about the education piece of how you're seeking to come alongside homeowners that maybe want to become more proficient when it comes to tools or be more empowered. Tell me about you're thinking about that.
So, well, my business right now has sort of two branches. One is the fabrication, where I will happily build you something cool, happily build you cool things. Or the other branch is what I'm dubbing like a DIY coach. And I will come help you build anything you want, be it cool, be it bookshelves, a floating shelf, you need to fix a table leg, like whatever it is at your level, I will happily meet you there and teach you what to do. And that has come about from decades of teaching, like in respect, both from like formal, like university level, high school level, informal, nannying, tour guiding, coaching, that kind of, it's all teaching. Like even just having interns, you're teaching. And so like it seems silly to let that experience go to waste. You know, I've got a really good, solid understanding of, I think it's hard for people who have decades of experience in a trade to remember what it's like to come from nothing or to come from very different angles, right? So also in that, like, I used to teach arts kids how to build scenery, you know, and that's not necessarily their main skill set, right? Like, a lot of times in theater, like, even the designers. So if you're not familiar with sort of the entertainment industry, theater specifically, if you look at the scenery on stage, there is somebody who designed it, and then there is somebody who did the engineering and gave it to the shop to build, okay? So the engineering kind of piece is called the technical director. That's what my sort of formal training is as. And then carpenters, prop artisans, painters, blah, 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 they're going to build it. So the person who designs it, depending on their background and where they went to school, they didn't necessarily get a strong education in physics, you know, or they've never had to budget their shows out because there's many schools of design that don't teach that. They're like, design it, and then they will figure out how to do the thing, right? And so a lot of times you get this design, and then your job is to figure out how to create the closest thing to it that not only, like, is in reality in terms of the space, but also the budget and, like, what you're capable of, like, even just your artisans. And so having dealt with, like, a lot of different expectations and coming from different angles, and sometimes you get kids that used to help their parents in the, you know, their dad, usually dad in the shop, work and building stuff their whole lives, and you have some kids that are, like, scared of a screw gun. And that's fine. That's a perfectly reasonable place to be. And so having, like, you know, a decade or plus experience in teaching and nurturing and trying to build that, it was just an absolute delight to stumble across, through the help of a client who wanted this, stumble across this idea of, like, coming in and teaching people how to manage their own home. Like, it's so empowering for homeowners to not have to call someone to change out a ceiling fan, you mm-hmm. know? It's a relatively simple thing, but you do want to have an idea of what you're doing. you know, lighting fixtures, like, you don't want to mess with electricity unless you have a general idea of what to, how to go about that. And so, like, to be able to come in, even people who bought tools because they knew they needed it, and maybe they know how the chop saw works, but maybe they don't understand the full scope of what you can accomplish with that, like with the mitering or with this, or do you have a table saw? You should know what you're doing if you have a table saw, guys. Or call me and I'll come help you. You know, or like all the different ways you can go about doing things. Mm-hmm. Yeah, everything from simple home repair to like building your dream table. I had a woman who has a huge cassette collection, like mm-hmm. vintage cassette collection that's hers and her father's. And we built this really cool table that was of her design using some reclaimed legs from chairs that she had that displays the cassettes. It has a cool Bluetooth cassette player on it. And you can like, it's like a statement art piece, wow. but it's a functioning coffee table. Yeah. So it's like build your dream wacky piece or just teach you how to use chop saw for a little while. Sure. And just being able to do that is really cool, I think.
Well, we're definitely going to link the content in terms of the photos that you just referenced. We'll link to your website as well for those that want to follow your journey of building that business or hire you to build some cool shit.
Yeah, thanks. I would love that. The wackier the project, like, hit me with it. I love that. Love the problem solving and the sort of dreaming part. You can also, on the Instagram, watch Danny and I try to put our house back together after pulling it apart.
I love that. Okay, we are now to our lightning round. Are you ready?
Lightning round. I don't know. Maybe. I'll do my best. I'm not necessarily the best with lightning rounds.
That's okay. Okay, number one.
Okay.
Becky, I'm curious, what's the last great book that you've read?
Well, I am currently in the middle of a book that has been fun and kind of good for me as someone coming from being an artist that is called You're a Badass at Making Money. Mm-hmm. And it's hilarious. I like the woman's like narrative tone. But it's just a lot about like sort of letting go of the stigma of like asking for what you're worth, because that can be very hard. And particularly a lot of artists have a hard time with that. And before then, I did a reread of a book called Dreamers of the Day, which I actually highly recommend for a lot of people. I read it years and years ago because I actually did a play about it. I was helping a friend with a community theater play about Dreamers of the Day. They did a great job, by the way, in New York. But it's about it centers around the 1921 Cairo Peace Conference, which really the events of that, and you're talking post-World War One, just out of the influenza epidemic. It's told from the viewpoint of a teacher, I believe. I know I just read it, but shush. Who takes like a trip of a lifetime to Egypt and ends up kind of just gonna like meet some people and get swept up in this. But like that conference post-World War One really laid the foundation of what has become the modern Middle East, and it was a very interesting read.
Wow.
Yeah, you're
okay.
welcome.
Well, that's soon to be on my Kindle.
Yeah, it's a good book.
Next question is, what's advice you give to your younger self?
Meditate earlier. Like, seriously, meditation has helped me immensely in life. And also, don't hit your head so many times under a platform, because I ended up having to go to a chiropractic neurologist to get that figured out. So, like, when you're crawling under a platform and you, like, stand up quickly, like, crack, like, I hit my head enough that I had depth perception and eye tracking issues. So,
oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it's cool. There's something called a chiropractic neurologist. It's an amazing field. Highly recommend them.
Okay. Today I learned. Next up, when you're flooded or overwhelmed, what's your best hack to self-regulate and come back to earth?
Breathing. Yeah, breathing, which falls into that meditation. Mm-hmm. So breathing and earplugs.
Okay.
Earplugs and breathing.
So I think maybe that goes into my next question, your favorite neurodivergent purchase. So as a neurodivergent person, what's like an object that you really leverage in your life? Would it be the earplugs?
It's probably the earplugs. Yeah, it was learning that sensory issues. And as I've gotten older, especially coming out of New York, like I said, being in New York for a long time, didn't do many favors in some ways regarding the neurodivergence. But learning that I have a lot of sound sensory like issues, which I don't know that I had, or if they just got worse, or just be more aware of them. Mm-hmm. But like just bringing it down, not like full on noise canceling, but just like the little loops and just like taking it down a notch really helps.
Well, that was mentioned last week on the podcast, Loop It. And so
love it. Love it, Loop.
I mean, if Loop wants to sponsor this podcast,
bring it, Loop.
I wouldn't be upset.
I should have warned them. You can see how cute they are.
Next up, what's a song or playlist that you have on repeat right now?
Oh, right now I have a working playlist, like a carpentry working playlist.
Okay.
That I've made. It has a lot of like sort of like 90s and 2000s. I've like been recently kind of doing a bit of a nostalgia thing. So it's got a lot of like Modest Mouse, the Violent Femmes. I love the Violent Femmes with like an unreasonable dedication for the band as it was, but I've just always loved them. So a lot of that and a lot of sort of like perky music like Queen or you know, kind of oldies.
Okay.
Yeah.
What's the best advice you've been given?
See, I wish I was better at like tracking this stuff through my life, because I will say that many people have given me many wonderful pieces of advice, including you yourself. You are absolutely fantastic at this kind of thing. But recently, I've just kind of like been given the advice and actually been able to receive and hear the advice to go after exactly what I want to do regarding my business unapologetically, and not just accepting work because someone is willing to pay me for it, as I've always sort of done in the past. And that comes from like constantly working at multiple jobs and just kind of like, you know, hustling the hustle, especially in New York.
Well, and it sounds like just even over the arc of all the answers you've provided today, you're really coming into your own in terms of like understanding your expertise as a teacher, your expertise in the arts and in crafting beautiful things that people don't expect. And you're incorporating that into your own house as well.
Yes, I hope so. I think it's going to be great. And yeah, thank you. You know, it's never too late.
Final question is, any last parting words of advice for neurodivergent people that are listening to this around the world?
Yeah, I would say that before I realized that neurodivergence was a thing, I always just thought that I was awkward or weird or something else. And like, no, it's not you. It's them. It's totally them. I would say for neurodivergent people out there, if you are similar to me in the fact that you, through trying to understand yourself and interact in the world in a way that was expected of you, developed multiple versions of yourself, you know, like work Becky is very different than friend Becky. And sometimes like merging the two gets complicated in my brain, right? And learning that sort of like often referred to as masking, that kind of thing. Like really sit down and think about the version of you that you are comfortable being
And then just like, just do it. Just go out there and do it. Be that person, because the people that you want in your life are going to be there for you. They're going to be there for that. They're going to support that. They're going to be like, hell yeah, you are rocking. And the people who aren't are, you're like, you don't need them. You're fine.
Mm. Yeah. What an exclamation point to the end of our conversation. So with regards to the audience, how can they get in touch with you or follow your journey? What's the best way to keep track of the badass Becky that we got to know today?
Instagram is where I'm the most active in terms of social media. Mm-hmm. And that is SaganWorks, my last name, S-A-G-E-N, Works. And then my website is SaganWorks.com. And
easy.
You can look through stuff there. My email's on there. You can DM me through Instagram. But that is where you'll find me. I try to keep it a little limited because, you know, ADHD.
You want to stay focused.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for telling us about your life. And I just am confident that someone else is out there listening to this on their walk, on their drive. And I just appreciate your radical candor through all this.
Thanks for thinking of me and inviting me to do this. This is fun. And it's good to like, it's very interesting to like reflect on this in life. So I appreciate it. I've also learned things about myself in talking about it.
Perfect.
Yeah. No, thank you very much.
Another great conversation in the books. It reminds me of the Soren Kierkegaard quote that says, "Life can only be understood backward, but it must be lived forward." And when I hear Becky's story, there's all these little details that she shares, you know, in her earlier adolescence and how that has informed the career that she finds herself in, whether it be teaching in a variety of ways or leaning into her creative talents, yet again, in a different modality. It gives me a ton of comfort and almost courage to see the serendipity that can come with life, but you kind of have to look backward in order for it to make sense. I find that it gives you courage to move forward, right, and to continue on. So my question for you today, as you reflect wherever you might be listening or watching this, is what's something that may have happened in your past that is informing what you're doing today? So if you're on Spotify, there's a Q&A feature. You can share your answer there. Or if you're watching this on YouTube, you can comment below. But I'd love to see your answers. I'd love to hear how you might see some of the parallels between Becky's story and maybe elements of your own life. With that, we'll talk to you guys next week.